hopefully it'll work. Okay.
All right. Looks great. Like it.
All right. I'm just going to read. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. What was the date and place of your birth?
Do we need to say that it's Susan Terrell? Would that be useful?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So you know, okay. Who's on the tape.
And then we're supposed to say her name. Yep.
Okay. And have me spell my name or something?
Yep. Okay.
So it's, the last name is T-U-R-E-L-L.
Okay.
Okay. Susan spelled the regular way, S-U-S-A-N.
Okay.
Okay.
I say my name, I think. So Megan Sherrier, C-H-E-R-R-I-E-R.
Yeah, in case someone's transcribing it, then they know.
They are.
Right. Okay.
All right. What was the date and place of your birth?
I was born July 10th, 1956, in Cleveland, Ohio.
Are you from Cleveland, then?
My family lived there just a couple of years, and we moved shortly after my second birthday.
Okay.
So, no, I really don't remember living there at all.
And you moved to Texas?
No, actually, we lived in... we moved to Columbia, South Carolina for about 2 years or so. Well, my dad was doing some military service there. And then we moved to Houston, Texas.
Okay.
So we moved there right around my fourth birthday.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is your ancestry or ethnicity?
That's a tough question, because people tend to think of ethnicity as race. And mm-hmm. So a lot of times when I have to check things off, I check off like Caucasian or something. But I'm Jewish, and for Jews, it's not just a religion, it's a culture. And so, I guess, you know, I think if you want my cultural heritage, it's being Jewish. So, mm-hmm.
Cool. How many male or female siblings do you have?
I have a sister, and I had a brother who passed away a couple years ago.
Are you the oldest?
I'm the oldest.
Oldest. Mm-hmm. Cool. Is your name and occupation if you have a partner or spouse?
Wait, those seem like two different questions.
Oh, what is the name and occupation of your partner or spouse
if
you have one?
I do have a partner, and she's the dean at one of the UW colleges.
Cool. Where did you attend school, and what degrees have you earned?
And let me just clarify on this. It's one of the UW colleges. It's UW Marathon County. It's not all of them.
UW.
Mm-hmm. Marathon, which is in Wausau. Where did I go to school? My undergraduate was from University of Texas at Austin, and my degree there was a liberal arts honors degree. So it was called Plan 2. It was a liberal arts degree. Honors. And then I went to University of Houston to get my master's in counseling, and then I continued on to get my PhD in counseling psychology from University of Houston. And I got that degree in 1992.
Okay, cool. Is there anything else about your general background you think is important?
No, I don't. I mean, there's lots of things about my background. I'm assuming they're going to come up when you ask other questions.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Describe your relationship with your parents and siblings when you were growing up.
Okay. I think in general I had a pretty average childhood. One of the values of most Jewish families is the value of education. So I remember things like we'd sit around the dinner table, and if we'd ask a question, you know, my parents would make us go get up and look up the answer. They wouldn't answer it for us, so we'd be looking up in the dictionary or the encyclopedia.
Cool.
So I think it was a fine relationship with them. I was the oldest, and my sister was 2 years younger than me, so I think there was a bit of competitiveness there. And we didn't get along very well when we were growing up. We fought a lot. My brother was 5 years younger than I was, and so you know, I cared a lot for him as a child. I mean, I was 5 years older, so, I mean, I remember when he was born. I remember my mom being pregnant with him. So I did a lot of caretaking of him when he was younger, but by the time I got to be a teenager, he was just a little brother that I really didn't want to have much to do with, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I think my parents were married until my mother died. They had, I think, a very good, strong, loving marriage. And, yeah, I think that's probably
awesome
enough for that answer. Let's see what else you're going to ask.
Tell me about the community and neighborhood where you grew up.
I grew up in a suburb in Houston that now is a very close-in suburb. When I moved to Houston, there were probably just 1 million people. Now there's 5 million, so it's grown a lot, and it's very geographically spread out. I lived in a neighborhood that had a disproportionate number of Jewish families living in it. We moved into a home that my parents had built for us, so that home was built for us, and my parents lived there until my mother died. So that was the only house I knew from about the age of 4 and a half or so to, let's see, Mom died in 92, so I was 36. So,
wow.
Yeah, so that house had a lot of, it was a very, you know, very stable.
Symbolic.
Yeah, very stable upbringing, I think. The neighborhood, it was suburbia. I grew up across the street from the elementary school I attended, walked to junior high. My high school was a little bit further away, but I would say upper middle class, ranch-style homes on probably a third of an acre. So we're not talking, you know, real ostentatious wealth, but it was a, people weren't hurting in that neighborhood. Definitely upper middle class. My dad was a physician. I don't know if you're going to ask that. My mom was stay-at-home mom, but did a lot of volunteer work, did a lot of service to the community.
What kind of physician was he?
He was an internist, and he specialized in cardiology.
Cool. Cardiology.
Mm-hmm.
Did your mom, like, choose to stay at home?
I think that's what they did back then. I know that she taught school for a while before she got pregnant with me. But back in the 50s, when I was born, women who were pregnant were no longer allowed to teach in public schools. So,
wow.
But I think that's, I think she was okay with it. I think that's what wives of that generation and class status did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she kept busy. I mean, she did a lot of service work, so.
Mm-hmm. So could she go back to teaching after?
She didn't want to.
Okay.
When we were grown and my dad was still working, she did go back and worked in his clinic and did insurance claims in the business office there. So she did do that, go back and did that work after. But it was more because I think she was interested in doing something and helping out that office more so than she certainly didn't need to financially. So.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Describe how your family was or was not connected to the community.
Oh, well, when you say community, I think of the Jewish community. So very connected. I mean, there we had my mother's brother and his wife and their 4 kids, my cousins, all lived within walking distance of where we grew up. So maybe 3-4 blocks away, not very far, long blocks away. So we would often, you know, do things with my cousins. Judaism is very much celebrated in the home, so there were a lot of family dinners together with grandparents coming in the home. My grandparents didn't live in town, but they visited a couple times a year and for the big holidays. And we went to synagogue. We went to Sabbath school. And we knew people, kids I went to school with were Jewish, and they lived in the neighborhood. So that was the sense of community. When we got to be a little bit older, I was grown. I was out of the house. I don't remember if my siblings were still there. My dad became president of the neighborhood association, so at that level of community, he did some service as well.
Mm-hmm. So is there a Jewish synagogue around here?
Around in Eau Claire?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's one.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's over on the East Hill. You know, it's on Emory Street. It's actually just a few blocks
Emory
away
Street.
From where I live.
Oh.
Uh-huh. But it's East Hill.
Mm-hmm. I'm very interested.
Do you know where East Hill is? If you go from campus and you travel toward downtown, like on, you know, get on State Street and go toward downtown, but don't turn to downtown, just go up that hill.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, the Brackett Street Hill or whatever it's called, up Brackett Street Hill?
Okay.
When you get to the top of the hill, there's a light that's called Margaret, and you'd make a left on Margaret and go down to Emory and make a left and go down about 2-3 blocks and you'll be at the synagogue.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's not open. It doesn't have services every Friday night, but you could probably look on their website and see.
Cool. I'm very interested. Ever since, all of Europe that we went to was very devoted to the Holocaust memorials and sad. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you could go there for some Friday night service if you wanted to check it out.
That would be great.
But that's how we had a sense of community. I mean, it was people we grew up with. My parents were friends with other Jewish families in the neighborhood. I knew the kids. I mean, and it wasn't all Jewish, obviously, but it was disproportionately Jewish in the neighborhood. It was called Meyerland, M-E-Y-E-R-L-A-N-D.
E-R.
L-A-N-D. The person who settled it was someone whose last name was Meyer.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Who had power and privilege in your community, and how did that affect you and your family?
Who had power and privilege in the community? I would say my family was part of the families that had power and privilege. It was probably more class-based than anything else. It was all white in the neighborhood at that time. It probably still is, honestly. So if you think of Meyerland as a community, our family was anybody who had a certain class status. I think my family probably had some because my dad was a physician, and he probably saw patients of, you know, people who were my friends' parents, you know, like he probably saw them as patients, I would guess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think who else. In that, if you cite that as a community, I would say if you look at, there were families within the Jewish community who had more status, but it was based on they were really wealthy, and they would tend to be the leaders in the synagogues and that kind of thing. They would run the big fundraising campaigns and stuff. I would say if you look at Houston as a whole, when I was growing up, it's interesting because back in the late 60s, it had to be late 60s, early 70s, they were really struggling with segregation of schools, and they started to set up zones, like districts, so that you would be zoned to a particular school as a way to integrate. But my sense is the way those were set up was really disadvantaged the students of color. A few of my friends got zoned to different schools than what they wanted to go to, but mostly I think it was a way to make sure that our schools were being integrated by making students of color be bused or moved to our school.
Hmm.
So.
Wow. What values did you learn from your family and other people and institutions in the community?
Okay. Certainly value of learning and education, for sure, in my family. I also learned social justice if you think about Judaism is very strong about social justice. So I learned a lot of values about that, about equity, about discrimination, about privilege. I learned about the importance of living a good life now. That was a really key value, that you don't wait for some heavenly reward, but you create a good life for you and people now because this is all you can count on. That's a strong value I have today even. You treat people well. You try to create a socially just world now. So, let me think. What else? I think growing up in Houston, which was such a city world, so many people were moving to all the time. I really learned the value of sort of welcoming people and diverse viewpoints. There really is a sense of like, come on, and really warm and welcoming, and really inclusive. That's not to say there aren't power differentials like we talked about before, but it's really there really are lots of communities of people from different backgrounds who live there, and I'm sure there is a hierarchy, but I think it's more about class than it is about ethnicity, I think. There's obviously intersections with that, but there's lots of integrated neighborhoods in Houston. I mean, it's much different than other places I've lived. So we probably have to turn it over?
Oh, yeah. It's only 45 minutes on that one, and then I have another tape.
Okay, there you go.
But I think maybe 20 minutes for each side.
That's probably about.
I don't know.
Okay.
Is it playing? Oh, yes.
Seems to be.
Okay, great.
But you have this one too, right?
Yeah. Okay. Just in case something goes wrong.
Good plan.
Yeah.
Okay. So the neighborhoods are integrated, is what I was saying. Not all of them, but some. No, not all.
Okay. What occupations do your parents pursue? Oh, yeah, we already covered that.
We did.
Okay. What role did education play in your life?
Oh, I think I mentioned that, too. Very strong. I mean, it was... the high school I went to was known for its academic rigor, I guess. I mean, there were lots of... I mean, it was... And almost every person I knew in high school was going to college. In fact, in my family, it wasn't even... It was just assumed I'd be going to college. There was no discussion. It was just like I knew I was going, and that was it. So lots of value on education. My dad told me... Oh, well, and I didn't go back to graduate school till I was 29. So, but even then, all in my 20s, he said, you know, if you ever want to go to school, I'll pay for it. So it was very much like, education's important, we'll support you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Cool. Give an example of how gender, race, ethnicity, and social class were important in the building of your understandings of yourself and society.
Okay.
That's a lot.
Gender, race, and ethnicity, and social class were important in building my understanding. Okay. I knew early on that I was discriminated against because I was female. I didn't have language for it until probably my 20s. Even though I took some women's studies in college, I just didn't have good language for it. But I was aware of discrimination based on gender early on. And challenged it, not real successfully, but challenged it. I don't think I was aware of class status issues until I had a very good friend in junior high who lived in a house that was probably not much bigger than this room. And it was the first time I realized not everybody lived like we lived. So, but I don't know that I was able to make much sense of it until I got into my 20s, honestly. I think I noticed it, but I didn't know how to make sense of it well until I got a little bit further along in my life experiences. Mm-hmm. I was aware of ethnicity issues early on as well. I certainly knew that there were just a handful of students of color like in my junior high and high school. And though there were no overt nasty interactions, there was nothing violent or anything, I'm sure that I wasn't fully appreciative of how hard it was for them. For us, it was just sort of like, oh, look, there's someone different that we can be friends with, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Almost mascot-like, I think, in retrospect. Mm-hmm. But early on, I remember distinctly, and I wish my mom was alive so I could talk to her about it, but I remember going to a downtown department store when we first moved to Houston, so I was probably 4 or 5. And I remember going to drink from a water fountain, and my mom said, don't drink out of that one. And I just couldn't figure out why. And here's my mother from upstate New York, had just moved to the South, probably thinking, what have I gotten myself into? And she's trying to explain to me why I can't drink out of one water fountain and why I have to drink out of the other. And it just didn't make it. And I can remember asking her, like, why? Is it different water? What's the, you know? And I know now it was like colored, quote-unquote, water fountain. So, yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, I was aware of that kind of discrimination early on. You couldn't live in Texas in the 60s and not be aware of it. There were a couple of race riots in different, you know, in the parts of town where people of color lived at the time. some of the more impoverished neighborhoods. Wow. There were riots and stuff. I mean, you were aware of it, but the way it impacted me the most, as I mentioned before, was more of the, in school, how they were integrating schools. That's how it impacted me more directly. And again, disproportionately probably disadvantaged other students as opposed to the white students. It wasn't just black students, it was Latinos too, okay. Right?
Yeah.
Right. And then in the early 70s, there was a big influx of people from Vietnam in Houston as well.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. There's lots of different cultures that live there now. That's just the tip of the iceberg now.
So was it like discriminated against if you were white and then you had a Hispanic friend? Was that seen as bad?
Not that I know of. No. Mm-mm. No, in fact, I would say probably more for my friends. When I got to be in junior high and high school, I didn't hang out with Jewish kids necessarily, and that was more of a problem because the Jewish kids tended to all hang out together, and I tended to branch out. So, like my friend who lived in the house that wasn't too much bigger than this wasn't Jewish, so that was more of a, that was more shocking, I think, in junior high.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Did the Jewish community get ever, like, discriminated against?
Oh, sure. Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah, but there's a fairly large one in Houston for a major city, I guess. And but I was probably buffered against some of it. I mean, there were certain neighborhoods Jews couldn't live in. Still is. That if there's a country club that wouldn't accept Jews unless they're really, really, like, one of the Jewish families who owned a department store, they got in. But they lived in that, neighborhood and belong to a big country club, but most, no, there's still that kind of, you know, anti-Semitism. I don't think it's not overt. I mean, there's not swastikas being painted on synagogues, but there is, there are, you know, sort of neighborhoods that are white, you know, kind of WASPy, really high income that Jews wouldn't live in.
Wow. Yeah,
that's why Jews lived in Meyerland, not that other neighborhood.
Oh.
Or there's another neighborhood that was even more... There was another neighborhood for Jews that had a lot more money than we had, and that was... Yeah.
Wow.
But they didn't live in the one with all the WASP, no. No. And still don't, as far as I know.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, what memories do you have of being discriminated against or seeing others who were victims of discrimination?
Well, I talked about the water fountain.
And
I would say for me, the first thing I remember real distinctly was I wanted to be bat mitzvahed. And it wasn't for any big religious reason. I think I just wanted the party and the presents that came with it at 13. So you had to start doing some studying for it around 11, I think, 10 or 11. And my parents refused and said, you're not going to get bat mitzvahed. They wouldn't let me because I was female. It was, of course, expected my brother was going to be, but, right.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It just wasn't done then. Now,
but
girls,
they do it now.
Oh, now girls get bat mitzvahed all the time. But, yeah, not then. Yep.
Wow.
And then there were other things like, you know, if I wanted to go spend the night, it had to be at my cousin's house. It had to be some friend that my parents knew really well. I probably didn't get to spend the night at all in elementary school with anybody other than my cousins. My brother could spend the night wherever he wanted, you know, that kind of thing.
Because you're a woman.
Because I was female, right.
Wow.
Yep.
What did you learn from experiencing or witnessing these acts of discrimination?
What did I learn? Well, I knew they were unfair, so I'm not sure what I learned other than just a recognition that they were unfair. And I don't like unfairness. I mean, I don't know, I want the world to be a just place, so I guess that's, I mean, I just, yeah. You know, I don't know if I was born this way, but I certainly have always questioned rules. If they make sense, fine. If they don't, I ignore them. So, you know, these would be some of those rules, I think, that are, you know, these social rules that I think are just horrible, so, yeah, they need to be challenged.
describe any efforts you witnessed or participated in to confront discrimination? What tactics or strategies were used?
Growing up? I don't think I saw any. No, if we're still in childhood, okay. No. I didn't see anybody challenge anything. My parents probably said some things that would have supported that. I mean, they would challenge it verbally, but nothing more overt than that. So I'm sure my mom tried to explain to me why this was, what was going on with these water fountains and why it was not okay. But nothing more overt than that.
What memories of your childhood continue to make a difference in your life?
I think the fact that my mother and her mother, my grandmother, both did so much service, I think they started taking me, mom, because, grandma, I wasn't living with, where she was living in upstate New York, but my mom would take me with her to go do some of that service when I was younger. I think that made a big impact. I think, the values we talked about earlier continue to make an impact. I would say not in a negative way, but in a more problematic way, I think growing up in an upper middle class family, that's the classism is the thing that's hardest for me to see. It's the easiest for me to fall into. So it's the hardest for me to see as a way to challenge it. So.
What significant historical events do you recall most clearly from your childhood, and how have they affected you throughout your lifetime?
Oh, gosh. There's significant historical events like Kennedy, like all those assassinations in the 60s, Kennedy's being shot, both of them, Martin Luther King being shot, even people like George Wallace, the attempt on his life. There was just such a time of violence, the Vietnam War, the protest, people landing on the moon. There were a lot of big changes and a lot of challenging the status quo that I think I still do. It's just lots of challenges to the status quo. And it was scary. This idea that people could just be assassinated so easily and that if people didn't agree with each other. So I think it, from what I read about generations, and I think there's some truth to this, that people who are baby boomers who lived through that, challenging the status quo stayed with us. We challenge the status quo in ways that maybe your generation doesn't. We assume people in authority maybe don't have our best interest at heart, and that they need to prove that they do, or that we need to be able to challenge and question. So, for me, it certainly has led to a life of challenging and questioning.
Looking back at your childhood, would you have anticipated that you would become a feminist later in life?
Yes, absolutely. As soon as I had the language board, it was like, oh, I'm home. This is me. Yeah, absolutely. I think I was a feminist from the minute I could think. I just didn't have the language. Yep.
What else would you like to share about your childhood experiences? Anything?
No, I can't think of anything else.
Cool. Then it says crafting feminist identities.
Okay.
Describe your educational path after high school.
I think I've already done that.
All right.
In terms of formal education, I would say informally. When I started working at the Australian Women's Center when I was 26, that was when I really got sort of immersed in my feminist education, which, I had a little bit of it in college when I took women's studies classes, but it was so beginning then in the mid-70s that, so when I started working at the Women's Center in the early 80s, it was like really eye-opening. It was discussions, it was reading, it was just, it all fell together there. So that was more my informal educational path.
describe your occupational path after college?
Sure. When I first graduated with my bachelor's, I immediately went into a doctoral program in school psych, and after a semester decided I was too young. I wasn't ready to be able to apply what I was learning in any kind of critically thinking way. So I went and worked for 3 years at the American Heart Association doing volunteer management, and then I worked for 3 years at the Eastern Area Women's Center doing volunteer management and directing the Rape Crisis Program. Then I went back, so I did that. Then I went back to school to get my master's and doctorate, and then I started teaching in 92. I taught at U of H Clear Lake for 10 years and coordinated women's studies there, and then I came here. So 6 years I did coordinating women's studies and teaching, and then last summer I began work as an administrator.
6 years you taught here?
I taught here for 6 years,
okay.
Right.
6 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And coordinated women's studies during that 6 years, too. I came here as coordinator of women's studies. Yep. And then became an administrator last summer.
So did you want to move to Wisconsin, or?
Yeah, I chose to.
Okay, hold on.
Okay. This runs out. Maybe it's only a 30-minute tape.
Yeah, maybe, like 15 minutes.
There
later.
It is. So oh, it says 60 on that one. There you go.
I don't know. I've never done it.
Do you want to mark on that one so that you know?
Yeah, like first one or something. First.
Yeah. There you go.
Thank you.
Sure. I use this a lot to dictate when I would see clients. Let me just also mention that during the time I've taught, I've always, until this past summer, I've always maintained a private practice as a psychologist. So I've always done part-time clinical work with people. And when I was in Houston, I also spent about 12 years being a clinical consultant for the Houston Area Women's Center. And it meant I would supervise some of their staff. I would supervise people going there to earn their hours toward licensure. And I did a lot of, trying to help working with staff, not just supervising, but working with them to do self-care, to try to help them consult with their cases, that kind of thing. So I did that for many years as well.
Wow. So you wanted to move to Wisconsin? Is there a particular reason?
I was tired of living in a really big city, and I wanted to live someplace smaller, prettier, less pollution, less crime, less crowded. I didn't want to spend my whole life living in Houston. I ended up moving back to Houston to take the job in University of Houston Clear Lake because my mother was ill at the time, and I thought I'd be able to kind of help out toward the end of her life, and she ended up dying. I was at the end of your doctoral program in counseling psychology, you do a year-long internship. Mm-hmm. My internship was out of town in a city called Denton, Texas. So she got sick right after I accepted that internship, and so I ended up driving back and forth quite a bit to come back home every, third weekend. And so when I took the job back in Houston, at that point I really hadn't expected to move back there. And I thought I would move somewhere else. Well, she was still sick. I took the job. And before I could finish my internship, she died.
Oh.
So, but, it was fine. It was a good place to be to establish myself professionally. It was fine. But I thought, might as well, time to move, we'll see what comes up. Yeah.
Okay. When and how were you awakened to social inequalities based on gender, race, social class, sexual orientation, and other layers of identity?
Okay. I think I've sort of mentioned that. I mean, there's these early experiences where I thought, oh my God, what's this? My own experiences, as well as what I saw around me. Really that informal, being at the Women's Center in the early 80s when the whole place would shut down for an afternoon and once a week, and we'd all, from the receptionist to the executive director, and we'd all just talk about feminism and what was going on, and it was really, and that's when I got exposed to a lot of that. Not so much the intersections, sometimes that, but yeah, I think I could say the intersections. I mean, it wasn't a very complex examination of how those all intersected, but certainly all those issues were talked about.
Wow.
Yep.
Yes. What memories do you have of your first encounters with a feminist or the subject of feminism?
You know, I, as an overt kind of topic, I would have to say, you know, a little bit in college, because I took some women's studies classes, but they really were things like women in history, and it wasn't a real feminist analysis. It was just sort of, this was back in the mid-70s, so it was really just really a barely beginning of women's studies. And so I would say that the real one was with when I started working at the Women's Center in 1982. Okay. That's really the... But, of course, everybody knew who Gloria Steinem was. I mean, you knew who certain key people were. It wasn't like they weren't in the news. Mm-hmm. So I guess sort of more popular media in kind of a superficial way before that.
What experiences, social movements, or events, or people were important in shaping you as a feminist?
You know, I think what always has influenced me more has been more personal connections as opposed to what's happening in this big, you know, sort of outside of who I really know. So I would say, you know, who shaped me as a feminist would be sort of those discussions. They were really powerful. We dealt with tough topics. Both what was happening within the Women's Center as well as more theoretically. I mean, I read lots of interesting, provocative stuff, but it was also dealing with what was happening between us. I would also say as role models, I think my grandmother, my mother's mother, is very much a feminist. I don't know that she would have labeled herself that way. But she certainly had those beliefs, I think.
Was your mom?
I don't think so. It wasn't like she wasn't, but she certainly knew I was, and I don't know if her... I don't think she disagreed with anything I did, but I think she would never have put herself, she would have never made those kind of public proclamations about herself. It wasn't something, she wasn't very politically oriented, politically in the sense of sociocultural, right, not politics.
And how was your grandma?
What about her?
A feminist? How was your grandma?
Because I think she was very progressive and always learning, and but I mean, she died when I was around 30, I think. I don't know that it's anything I never talked to her specifically about it, but I know she... Her ideas were congruent with it.
Cool. And that was your mom's mom?
My mom's mom.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What memories do you have? Oh, I heard you said that. 22. Okay. What resistance, if any, did you face from people you cared about when you became a feminist?
You know, a little bit of, I would say a little bit of pushback from my family of origin, but not really much. You know, I was in my 20s. I could pretty much hold my own with any discussion. I didn't care to argue with them. I learned pretty early on that, you know, I don't care about changing other people's minds. It's just about living as a feminist for me. So it's about my ideas, my values, how I live my life. I don't try to convince others. I think they, you know, I think they probably try to engage me more. They probably tried to engage me more into arguments than I was really interested in. So a little baiting, but nothing really big. And there are some areas that, like with my dad, we just agree to disagree, and I tend not to discuss stuff like that with them. They just, if they want to bring it up, fine, but... You know, I don't care about convincing anybody of anything at this point. Even students, it's like, here's the information, you know.
Take it or leave it.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Right? Think about it, and then take it or leave it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Describe the process you went through as you decided to identify as a feminist.
You know, it just was such a good fit. I don't know that it was a... It was like, it just felt like it was me, and I have integrity. I want to For me, it's about integrity. It's about congruence of living your values. It just was easy, given that. I can't imagine not being true to myself. So,
feminism has been described as a river with many
tributaries?
Tributaries, yeah. In other words, although feminists are united by some common beliefs, they understand and express those beliefs differently. How do you describe the tributary of feminism that best fits your beliefs?
Can you tell from the feminist theory class?
Yeah, I'm about four of them.
Can you tell what I am?
Oh.
Probably not.
No. Radical?
Well,
I don't know.
I think, no, I mean, probably I would say, you know, I probably lean more toward radical, but I, you know, multicultural really kind of fits for me. But I think multicultural has roots in radical, so, you know, but multicultural, it's like I think you have to look at the intersections, but I think there's patriarchy, I think there's hierarchy, I think there's oppression, I mean, and I think people have privilege, and I think you have to look at the intersection of all those types of privileges, and I think, yeah, you have to undo all those hierarchies, so that's the one that resonates for me. But don't tell anybody, because I don't want... No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, no?
No,
okay.
I'm just kidding, but I'm just saying that I don't want students in that class because I really want to try to present the theories as fairly as possible, so... I don't
want to... Do you not want me to say that?
No, you can say it for the paper. I don't care.
Okay.
But y'all are in advance. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. What meaning does the feminist statement, "the personal is political," hold for you?
Oh, several things, I think. Part of it is that you can't just look at one woman's life. It's when you look at a woman's life in the context of sexism and other women's lives that you begin to see the bigger picture, and that women end up blaming themselves when they tend to decontextualize. So if they get raped, if they don't see it in the context of how sexual violence is a tool of patriarchy, they blame themselves. If they see it as part of that bigger picture, it tends to put the responsibility back on the oppressive. On the oppressor, right, and whether it's the cultural piece as well as the individual perpetrator piece. So I think, to me, it's like it's putting a context around people's lives that's really important. That context, I think, is crucial to make meaning out of people's lives who are oppressed.
Negotiated and balanced your identity as a feminist with constraining cultural expectations for femininity or masculinity?
Okay, so how have I
negotiated and balanced your identity as a feminist?
Gosh, that's a hard question. I'm not even sure how to answer it. You know, I don't know how to answer it. I just, I think I, getting back to the challenging piece, I think I challenge a lot. So I challenge, concepts like femininity, masculinity. I think it's been easier as I've gotten older. I think probably in my late 30s, around then, it just became much easier to say, this is who I am, and sort of, it didn't matter whether it fit traditional femininity or traditional masculinity. It's just who I am. So it's about that, living a congruent life with my values and who I am. So for me, I tend to discard concepts that don't work well for me, and I challenge them. So I guess that's how I would answer that question.
Good. what have been the greatest challenges you have faced as a feminist?
The greatest challenges. I think the greatest challenge is how to live congruently. It's very hard to not act in patriarchal ways when you live in a patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And to try to be true to in translating feminist values into how I live my life. That's the biggest challenge. Mm-hmm. It's not easy.
So,
yeah.
Which of your contributions? I'm saying that wrong. Contributions. Yeah. Have made the greatest difference in shaping feminist theories and practice, and your own understanding of yourself as a feminist.
Okay, let's start again. I need. Can I
read
that?
Which of your
in shaping feminist. Okay, made the greatest difference in shaping feminist theories and practices. I don't know which theories and practices, but which of my contributions? You know, I would say I'm really an expert around sexual violence and the whole patriarchal violence piece. So I'd say that's probably my biggest understanding, and understanding that, you know, that in the context of, I think, a rape culture. So I think that's a contribution I've made to the feminist world and people I know. I think my living as a feminist, as I mentioned before, I do think that makes a big difference. I think people don't experience someone acting outside of patriarchal norm often. I hope that makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think understanding myself as a feminist, I think part of what I think I've had to negotiate is sort of as you notice your contribution and you notice your expertise, there's a empowerment to that. And so how to bring that empowerment in a way that doesn't become power over or control. So that's been a challenge in terms of how I think about myself. It's like how to balance that is something I think about often. Because I feel like I have power, but I don't want it to be control over others. I have I'm empowered. I don't want to have power over. I want to use that power to empower others. But it's hard to do that sometimes.
What do you consider your major contribution to the success of the Women's Studies program?
Did you skip down a bit?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Yeah, I think we're still way up here.
I was, like, underlining that.
Yeah. We did that one.
Yep.
Achievements of feminism?
Right here, maybe.
Okay. What do you consider the greatest achievements of feminism over the last 25 years? Certainly, you know, liberal feminism got some laws changed. I don't think those are the greatest achievements, but they're certainly visible. I think the fact that it has touched individual women's lives in positive ways, even if the women don't realize it, that it's a feminist movement that did that. I think the anti-sexual assault and anti-domestic violence work that's been done has made a difference. It's now something people know about. Women do have better access to jobs. We still are lagging terribly in pay. I don't think we've diminished the violence. I think it's been more about awareness than actual change, honestly. More awareness. But remember, I'm really kind of rooted more in radical. I think the system doesn't work. And so everything that's really been done in the past 25 years has been within the system. So I want to be hopeful that people's attitudes and individual lives have had some positive change in them because there have been, you know, women realize they don't have to blame themselves if they're raped or they don't have to stay if they're being abused or that kind of things. But I think the reality is for most people it's not all that different. because we're still working in a patriarchal, it's still a patriarchal mm-hmm. system. So mm-hmm. there's my radical root showing through.
Okay. What do you think are the most important challenges feminism must overcome in this century?
I think one is we have to reclaim the term, and people have to feel comfortable embracing it when they really do have those values. Lots of people I know say, I believe these beliefs, but I don't consider myself a feminist. And uh-huh. it's like, but that is a feminist having these beliefs. So I think sort of overcoming the stigma of the term and having people embrace it would be a good thing to do. I really do think we have to, I think the current system doesn't work. I think we need that would be a really big challenge, but really kind of change the power structure in the country. If I can dream big, we got another, 91 years. it'd be great if more people who shared these beliefs were actually in positions of power who could and make some of those structural changes.
Mm-hmm.
I think women absolutely have to be able to control their reproductive lives. That's the bottom line. That has to happen. Because if you can't control your reproduction, most other things don't fall into place.
Mm-hmm.
And one, sexuality. I would say reproduction and sexuality. I think those are bottom line. So let's just take a little break here. So how much, is it just these?
Just that and...
There's more on the other page? Okay. So let me get Jan to call my next appointment and see if I can be like 15 minutes
okay.
late.
Okay, great, thank you.
Uh-huh.
What ways have you been engaged with UW-Eau Claire's Women's Studies program?
Okay. I came here in 2002 to be the coordinator. That was a half-time position I held until the summer. And then, I administered the program. That's the capacity. Oh my goodness, look what just flew in.
Oh!
Butterfly. Yeah. Oh my cool. God, where did that come from?
Spring.
Hello. Is a moth or a butterfly?
Yeah.
Oh my God. What a nice.
That's cool.
That is very cool.
Ah.
Okay.
Cool.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
So I've done that, and I'm not sure what else you need to know about that. I mean, you know specifics about what that entailed, or? No.
Okay. I don't know. What is your first memory of the program?
Oh, interviewing. Interviewing for the position. And, that was my first memory, is coming in and meeting a bunch of people who are on the search committee and meeting students and, figuring out, like, I liked it here. I thought it was a good fit, and they obviously thought so for me, too. And, it was about a two-day interview, so I got to meet lots of people and gave lots of presentations. And that was my first memory.
Cool.
I came in February. It was, like, around 32, so it was, like, a good, gentle way to ease me in. There wasn't a lot of snow on the ground. It must have been one of those mild winters. So
Yeah. How has the program changed during the time you have been involved?
Oh, goodness. Lots of changes. When I came, there had been a previous director Allison Harder's grandmother, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sarah Harder.
Yep.
She had been here and had been a longtime coordinator of the program. She retired, I think, in 2000. And there was a two-year interim person, Jenny Shattuck. And during that 2 years, they did a really good job of doing a program review and getting some direction to the program, setting up some committees to help run it. Mm-hmm. And so when I got here, we were able to implement lots of changes. We were able to get a vision for the program, set learning goals for students. We were able to get a major. At the time, there was only a minor. We were able to get a major. And that was the first major that had been a new major through UW-Eau Claire that had gone through in a very long time. So we've done that. We did that since I've been here. We've developed an alumni presence because we now have a major. We've gotten more awards for students. We've more clearly defined what some liaison work is about, creating connections for students to the program while they're here and when they're gone. We've developed more formalized internship sites. Shored up some we made some curricular changes. We shored up the curriculum. Shored up, like strengthened the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, got rid of electives that really weren't mm-hmm. relevant to women's studies.
Really?
Added some courses. Oh, yeah, we've really strengthened the curriculum. Yeah, all that.
Mm-hmm. Why was there only a minor?
The program started with a minor many years ago. And
huh.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yep.
Okay. What are the major contributions of UW-Eau Claire's women's studies to the campus, community, and beyond?
I think to the campus, it's a major contribution. We have courses that are cross-listed in lots of other disciplines, and those mm-hmm. disciplines are strengthened by the fact that they have a course that does a gendered analysis. We're obviously a presence that speaks to climate issues, not just for women, but for all oppression. Folks in women's studies are involved in lots of organizations and committees and bring feminist perspectives around social justice to those. I still feel like I'm a representative of women's studies even when I'm working in administration, so I'm bringing those perspectives up to this mm-hmm. this kind of work. In the community, we do programming. I mean, there's programming that's done. I mean, we collaborate with people like Wage and CASA and all that. So there's programming done for the community. I think that the internships people do, you all do as students. I think we're a visible presence. I remember once around the time the major was starting, I remember somebody told me some of the students in their non-women's studies classes were complaining that this campus was too feminist. So I think we were pretty visible. And if there's something going on, like the flip side, or a couple years ago, the calendar issue, we're pretty visible around exploring those issues and looking at what does it mean that we have to deal with these kinds of media on our campus. Still there?
Cool.
Yeah.
Share any stories of people and or events that you think are significant in the shaping of the 25-year history of women's studies at Eau Claire.
Okay. I actually think women's studies has been here more than 25 years. I think the minor might have been here 25 years. So I'm pretty sure women's studies has had a presence since the 70s, at some point in the 70s. People that shaped it, I can only speak really for the last 6.5 years. When the Forum was developing their speakers, the year we got our major, they brought in Gloria Steinem, and they worked with us to to work with the Time, and we had her here, I think in September, when we first opened the major. That was really exciting, and that was actually her second visit here. We've had lots and lots of speakers come in through Women's History Month. We've got lots of talented, talented faculty and staff on campus who help. It would be hard to name them all.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many, and I'm so pleased that there's such a widespread support for the program. I think there's ways that the program has had an impact that I don't even know, because you think about all the students that went through, and, you know, we don't hear back from most students, so we don't know what y'all are out there doing that's really powerful.
Yeah.
Right? So I would hope there's a ripple effect. There's lots of change going on in the world around, you know, in the region and in the world around us, because you all have been trained to question and to think about things in a using a gender analysis, right? Look at injustice. Mm-hmm. Try to fix it. Mm-hmm. Make the world a more just place.
What would 36?
I think.
What do you consider your major contribution of the success of the program?
My major contribution to the success? I think I provided good leadership for 6 years. And by good, I mean, I think it was inclusive, brought lots of people together. I wasn't afraid to speak up. Mm-hmm. I was visible. I think I connected well to students. So I put a visible face to the program, one that was, I think, an effective visible face. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid to speak out, but I think I have the ability to speak out in a way that, I mean, I don't care if people don't like what I have to say, but I think I do it in a respectful way. So I think sometimes people listen because of the manner in which I speak out. And I took what the women who did before me, and I found out in that plan that I stepped into, and I implemented it. So I really used their wisdom to help move the program forward.
Okay. What would you like your legacy in the Women's Studies program to be?
Oh. That's a good question. I don't think I'll ever see it. I would love my legacy to be that you students are out there doing good work, you know. And that, you know, and when I say good work, I mean making the world a better place, right? That would be the best legacy, that you all are out there doing the work so that, you know, when my generation is tired or dies off or whatever, there's still a feminist presence in the world. That would be the best legacy. Sorry.
Are you okay?
Oh, yeah. It's just, you know, it's just powerful to think about that. That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I feel things powerfully, I tend to cry. Yep.
Well, I don't have enough. Oh,
you
yeah.
Turn it over.
Yep. I was like, I thought it was all done.
Yeah.
As you think about the future, what role do you think Women's Studies will play on the UW-Eau Claire campus, community, and beyond?
I hope it continues to have a strong visible presence and continues to have leaders who speak out about social justice issues. That's what I would hope. And that the curriculum would become more and more integrated into other departments. There would be more collaboration across departments, so that they're adding classes with a gendered analysis into their curriculum, which I think is crucial, and that those, you know, then also complement what students in Women's Studies proper are learning.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what else would you like to share about Women's Studies program at Eau Claire and its impact both historically and in the future on the campus, community, and world?
Trying to think what else there would be to add about it. I do you get campuses that have women's studies programs that are strong, like here? I think it bodes well for the entire institution in terms of ability to think in creative ways, to challenge the status quo, the true kind of meaning of academic freedom, where you really think carefully about what you're presented and why you're presented it and what you're not being presented and all of that. You know, what's not being taught is just as important as what mm-hmm. is being taught, right? Whose mm-hmm. perspective is it from, all that. So I think a strong women's studies program is really evidence of a strong university. I think it's important that women's studies keeps a strong feminist focus, that it really is feminist studies, and that it not revert back to what other people have called add women and stir. So it's not just a course, for example, you know, like you learn about like women in psychology. It's not just like, okay, let's look at how psychology, let's look at the studies that are done on women in psychology, but let's ask the bigger questions. Why are they done? What perspectives are they done from? What's being left out? Do that real feminist analysis, I think, is crucial. And I think that's what makes the program here strong, is people are not afraid to say it's a feminist program. I think that's crucial. I do think, as we look toward the future, I think you can keep that feminist focus and include gender as part of the studies, not just women. I think we have to look at how patriarchy affects men, as part of women's studies. So women's studies doesn't really fit as a title, and we mm-hmm. do that in a lot of classes. Mm-hmm. And so it's really, I think we don't want to lose the women focus, and I think if you call it gender studies, you do. But I think if you can somehow call it women and gender studies, it's really sort of catching up more with where more current thought and experience has taken us. I think that's a useful thing into the future for the program. Maybe even add about sexuality. Of course, in my dreams, I'd love for it to just be called feminist studies, but I think that would freak a few people out. I'm not sure students would want to get a degree in feminist studies, but I think that's truth in advertising. That's what it is and needs to be.
Mm-hmm. So. I got this email about you are hosting a social gathering uh-huh. to discuss the sense of community for the LGBTQ uh-huh. faculty, staff, and students.
Yep.
What is that all, like, what will that entail? Like, everyone, what are you...
There'll be refreshments. There's going to be a brief, like, little intro by Beth Helwig, I think, and it'll be talking about really kind of developing a community. I mean, that's... looking at trying to develop more of a community presence on campus, because there was a study done, I guess, last spring by some folks in social work that really found there really isn't much of one, and the only one that exists is Spectrum, and that mm-hmm. kind of wavers based on who's in leadership, right? And
mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm in it.
Right. But, I mean, depending on, you know, what y'all do really depends on how many people are involved, who's the leadership, right?
And politics.
Right. And so... But there's no faculty staff present, so it doesn't seem mm-hmm. fair to leave the whole thing to students. So mm-hmm. that's what it'll be.
Okay.
Yep.
I was interested about that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's it, I think.
Okay.
And you have some sign things.
Can you stand in the back?
Thank them.
Oh. Okay.